ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Thursday, the 26th of February. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, thousands out of work as one Australian tech firm declares mass layoffs. Many are asking if it's a sign of more to come in the AI revolution. And from protest to pride, Sydney's gay and lesbian Mardi Gras parade immortalised on the National Heritage Register.
Stop police attack on gay women and blacks!
Who would have thought that 48 years ago this would be happening? This is a huge day for us, and it helps amplify the fact that Mardi Gras is a beacon for people around the country.
Battle lines are being drawn between Treasurer Jim Chalmers and his new opposite number, Tim Wilson. There are less than 3 months until the federal budget is handed down, and inflation is a hot topic on both sides of politics. The government says it's focused on the challenge, but the shadow treasurer has accused the government of throwing fuel on what he calls the inflation fire. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
He's been in the job for 10 days, and Shadow Treasurer Tim Wilson isn't mincing his words when it comes to inflation.
Inflation is a reflection of what happens when the government spends too not much, not when consumers spend too much. They're trying to hide it, and we know that they're pouring more debt petrol onto the inflation fire.
Inflation remained above the Reserve Bank's target band last month. Trimmed mean inflation, which is the RBA's preferred measure of underlying inflation, rose to 3.4% in January, up from 3.3% in December, and hotter than expected. Treasurer Jim Chalmers acknowledges inflation remains higher than the government would like.
I assure your listeners that the government is very focused on this inflation challenge. It's a big part of our thinking in the lead up to the budget in May.
The Treasurer promising an ambitious budget.
And it will recognise the pressures on people, but also the pressures more broadly on our economy, whether it's the inflation challenge, this long-standing productivity challenge we've had in our economy, all of this global economic uncertainty. These are the key factors and pressures that we're focused on as we get closer towards making some key decisions.
Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock spoke at a Melbourne University event overnight.
Inflation is a bit elevated. I don't think we think it's taking off again, but it's a little bit elevated.
She conceded the economy is, in her words, a little tighter than we thought, and as a result says policy decisions are less clear-cut.
The economy is sort of recovering, and this is where it's difficult. So the judgments are a little bit more difficult. It's not like we've got a situation where it's very clear what we have to do. We've got ourselves to a position now where it's close to balance, maybe a little bit tight, and that's why people have to be patient.
The Shadow Treasurer was at odds with her inflation assessment, though.
The evidence just doesn't show that. We have 4.9% of essentially domestic inflation. This is a homegrown challenge. And so long as state and federal governments continue to spend as they are, inflation will continue to be a problem for the economy.
Deanna Messina is the Deputy Chief Economist at AMP. She believes Michelle Bullock's assessment is fair.
Inflation is a problem when it's running at 4, 5, 6% on the trim mean basis. You know, we're talking levels that are slightly over 3%. It's not enough to derail economic growth.
She says it's unfair to lay the blame solely on the government for the elevated inflation numbers.
I think it's easy to blame, you know, one particular sector for causing the inflation problem. But I think it's a bit of a cop-out. The story is so much more nuanced than that. The inflation problem is partly to do with elevated government spending, but it's not just that. It's everything in the economy. And I think that the RBA has tried to do a good job of explaining this to people. When they think about the inflation problem, they look at aggregate demand overall, which is private and public spending. And we've seen a pickup in private spending in 2025, particularly in the last 6 months, at a time that government spending has remained elevated.
Still, she believes the main thing economists want to see the government deliver in its May budget is spending restraint.
That is difficult to do because that ultimately means we need to cut services for people, because why does the government spend money? Because it's providing services to Australia. those are going to be tough decisions that the government has to make. But that's ultimately the best way to help with the inflation problem, is to not keep adding to demand at a time that the supply of the economy is constrained.
That's AMP economist Diana Messina, ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. The future shape of Australia's economy is changing quickly as AI tightens its grip, particularly in technology sectors. The loss of 2,000 jobs at software logistics firm WiseTech has experts urging young Australians to think hard about their career choices in a rapidly changing jobs market. Stephanie Smale reports.
When Darcy Stevens started his computer science degree at the University of Adelaide, he had high hopes for his career, and he wasn't alone.
I remember walking into one of my lectures and there was 600 people enrolled in that course. That's a lot of competition, and the reason we had so much competition is because everyone's going, well, computer science is a good degree and it's a good field. Well, I'll get a lot of money when I get a job.
Darcy Stevens now works in cyber risk and compliance. The 21-year-old counts himself lucky he got a job and says only a fraction of his friends are now employed, with many having to keep studying.
It's rough. There was a lot of anxiety before we graduated, and now I've graduated and it's just even worse. But yeah, it does feel like, unfortunately, the skills that I learned, the skills that we learned and developed as a cohort won't be necessary in the future.
The AI threat is real for these young professionals across the globe, and they're venting their frustration online.
She's a software engineer whose job was stolen by AI.
Wait, what?
If someone said this to me like 5, 10 years ago, I'd be like, you are joking.
A lot of people feel so distant from this, but the deal is it's actually knocking on our doors right now.
In Australia, software logistics firm WiseTech says it's shedding 2,000 jobs, pointing out AI can do a lot of the manual coding humans used to do. So what does this mean for young Australians considering a career in tech? Professor Janine Dixon is the director of the Centre for Policy Studies at Victoria University. She says there are some jobs, like manual coding, that simply won't survive as AI's grip gets stronger on our economy.
It's going to be important not to oversupply that sector going forward. So it's going to be important in our career advice to young people to proceed with caution into those sorts of roles.
Do we need to be more clever about pivoting to use AI as opposed to not doing a technological job at all?
That's absolutely right. We do need to be more clever about using AI effectively. But I think in terms of just the sheer numbers of people, we'll probably need fewer people.
Figures from UN agency, the International Labour Organization, indicate more than 30% of jobs in Australia could be done by AI. But Professor Dixon says many of those jobs could stick around for years yet. She says it's up to us to learn how to use AI to our advantage as the technology keeps developing.
A lot of jobs won't be replaced actually by AI. They'll be helped by AI.
Australian companies say they are trying to manage the changes, with Commonwealth Bank announcing technology-related job cuts, but also unveiling a plan to help train staff. Professor Toby Walsh is the chief scientist at the University of New South Wales AI Institute. He says support is slowly improving for Australia's workforce as it grapples with AI.
It is going to be disruptive. One thing I would welcome is that the government has started to wake up to that idea and is putting its priorities now on the worker, realising that we really need to support people through the transition.
Professor Toby Walsh from the University of New South Wales AI Institute, ending that report by Stephanie Smale and Alison Shaw. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on ABC Listen. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. A US attack on Iran is looking ever closer as the buildup of American firepower in the Middle East continues. In his State of the Union address, US President Donald Trump accused Iran of sinister nuclear ambitions and warned he wouldn't hesitate to proceed with military action. The Australian government has directed the families of Australian diplomats in Israel and Lebanon to leave, while other Australians have been urged to leave while they can. How are Iranian Australians feeling about the imminent threat? Kambiz Razmara is the Vice President of the Australian-Iranian Society of Victoria. He joined me earlier. Kambiz Razmara, do you know how many Australians are in Iran right now?
At the moment, we're not sure. We're not getting much news coming out of Iran in terms of how many Australians are stranded or any resident, how many Australian residents or citizens are stranded in Iran.
DFAT advice at the moment for Australians reads, we continue to advise Australians do not travel to Iran and if you're in Iran, leave as soon as possible. What sorts of avenues are available to any Australians who are in Iran to get out?
Going by what happened during the 12-day war last year, most people had to try and make their way to neighbouring countries, either on land or by air, but it was then pretty difficult. We expect if there's any consular support required, as the consular services are now suspended in Iran, their people would have to reach out either online or by phone or in the neighbouring countries.
Do you have family members there and what have they said about the situation and the mood right now?
I have family members and obviously in Iran and within our community, many family members try and communicate via social media and typically everybody is reeling from the possibilities of what's likely to happen, frightened by the prospect, excited by possibilities of change. So it's a very mixed emotion.
Can you describe some of those communications that you've received? You said that you reach out on social media at times.
Yeah. A few days ago, the university students started protesting again and images that come out of Iran with frightening semi-automatic machine guns sitting in front of university entrances to generate fear. People are treated horrifically. People are treated when they're out protesting, and it's just heartbreaking.
Is it true to say that while there is a fear of what's to come, there might be many who do believe that nothing will ever happen to the regime without foreign intervention?
The reality is that we're dealing with a regime that knows violence as a means of control, so they will exert it. People have no way of defending themselves, but the desperation is at a level where people are seeking change. To bring about change, it is very difficult for people to fight guns, automatic machine guns, and sheer numbers of revolutionary guards who roam around larger cities and smaller cities and intimidating people. So that vexed situation is so troubling for people that you know, there's no other way out that people see. So they are hoping that foreign intervention of sorts will weaken the regime so that then change can be brought about. As to how, no one really knows. The only one, I guess, who knows is Mr. Trump and his inner circle.
Kambiz Razmara, thanks very much for joining the world today.
I appreciate your time and your interest. Thank you.
And Kambiz Razmara is the Vice President of the Australian-Iranian Society of Victoria. Would you know what to do if you realised you had a gambling problem? Australia has a self-exclusion register where problem gamblers can block themselves from all online betting platforms. But a review tabled to Parliament this week says too few people know about it, and anti-gambling advocates wonder why the federal government isn't doing more. Angus Randall reports.
This is Rugby League, and when you drop that energy into Las Vegas, that's your off-season solved.
This weekend, the rugby league season launches in Las Vegas, gambling capital of the world, and the AFL isn't far behind. Opening round is just 1 week away, and gambling companies want you to know.
At Sportsbet, we're proud supporters of those who have a crack at a Czechside banana from the boundary.
Those who worry their gambling is getting out of control can sign up to BetStop, Australia's self-exclusion register. It allows people to self-exclude from all online gambling sites for a minimum of 3 months up to a permanent ban. An independent review into BetStop, tabled by the federal government yesterday, found the program is largely working. The problem is, too few know it's an option. The Reverend Tim Costello is the chief advocate for the Alliance for Gambling Reform.
I don't know why we still have those almost blah, blah, you lose more than you win ads, you know, when you see a sports betting ad, rather than BetStop being actually advertised.
Charles Livingston is a gambling researcher at Monash University. He agrees with the review's call for a BetStop marketing blitz.
There needs to be more general advertising by the federal government about the availability of BetStop and what it can do. And secondly, I think the bookmakers need to be required to make the BetStop access portal much more clear on their website.
He also supports the review's recommendations that make it more difficult for those on the register to get off.
The best way to do it in the way that it's done in other jurisdictions is to allow people to do so, but only after they have satisfied either a gambling counsellor or someone acting on behalf of the regulator that they feel that whatever issues they had with gambling are behind them.
In 2023, a committee led by Victorian Labor MP Peter Murphy, who died from cancer later that year, released a report recommending significant reform of the gambling industry. At the time, it garnered near universal support across the political spectrum, but the federal government is yet to respond. Tim Costello is stunned at the lack of action.
I am absolutely astonished that it's 1,000 days. And there has not been a response. I could not ever have believed that this would be what would happen.
He says he's gone to the government directly with little success.
We had a meeting with Annika Wells soon after the May the 3rd election. We were having a meeting just before Christmas, and the meeting had just started, and unfortunately she was called away because that was the travel routes. I think she was called away to the Prime Minister. We haven't had a meeting since.
In a statement, a government spokesperson says they will carefully consider the recommendations from the report into BetStop, and the government will continue to work with stakeholders to reduce the harms of online gambling. In a statement, Responsible Wagering Australia CEO Kai Cantwell says the RWA has long supported BetStop as a critical harm minimisation measure and welcomes sensible recommendations to strengthen awareness, close gaps, and reduce opportunities for circumvention.
Angus Randall, and if you or someone you know needs help, you can call the National Gambling Helpline on 1800 858 858. The mayors of three inner city councils in Melbourne are proposing a merger. They say they're under financial pressure and need to amalgamate to survive. Local governments around the country are facing rising costs, leading to the loss of some vital council-run services, such as in-home care for the elderly and community childcare centres. But are mega councils the answer? Bridget Fitzgerald takes a look.
It's 2016 and protesters are descending on a town hall in Sydney. Emotions were running high at the first meeting of the newly amalgamated Inner West Council. A local official was spat on and the New South Wales riot police were called in. Almost a decade on, the amalgamation remains controversial among some residents, but it still stands. And it represents a broader trend as Australia's population grows. Along with the demand for community services, the number of councils around the country is shrinking. Now, a group of mayors in Melbourne is pushing for another mega council.
Our population is about to double. We need more services, more staff, more frontline services.
Stephen Jolly is the mayor of the city of Yarra, representing inner eastern and northern suburbs of Melbourne. Frustrated by the rising costs of delivering local services, Yarra is proposing a merger with the cities of Melbourne and Port Phillip to the south of the CBD.
Amalgamation is the last resort for us.
Stephen Jolly says merging with the other two councils, particularly the city of Melbourne, which receives more in rates from commercial businesses, is essential to Yarra's viability.
The CBD is like a river of gold to them, really. I mean, they don't get many services in the CBD. It's mainly businesses, obviously, but they all pay rates.
Nicholas Rees is the Lord Mayor of the City of Melbourne. He says he's open-minded about the proposal.
If you can achieve scale and
efficiencies and deliver better services to people and keep their rates at a reasonable level, then I'm duty bound to say, well, let's have a look at that.
But Nicholas Rees says the idea is yet to be officially considered by the City of Melbourne, and he'd only agree to the merger if it benefits his constituents. There are currently 537 councils across Australia, down from more than 800 in the 1990s. Councils merge and local government boundaries are redrawn for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's simply a shift in population growth and where people live, but it can be about financial pressures and sustainability. Roberta Ryan is a professor of local and regional governance at the University of Newcastle.
50 years ago, councils weren't providing childcare services, weren't having to deal with the scale of, you know, natural disasters, floods, fires, you know, bike paths, all these things that communities reasonably want and expect.
Roberta Ryan says each council is different, but broadly, many are under increasing pressure to provide more services without the ability to increase revenue. And in some cases, such as Victoria, council rate increases are capped, further limiting available funds. She says amalgamation has the potential to improve efficiency while retaining services such as maternal and child health nurses, aged care and childcare.
Particularly in areas like IT, payroll, HR, those kind of back office support services.
But she warns those kinds of efficiencies also require investment.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. For close to half a century, the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras parade has woven its way through the city's streets. Now the parade is set to become a landmark in its own right, with the 2-kilometre route to be placed on the National Heritage Register. Nick Grimm reports.
Happy Mardi Gras!
When tens of thousands of people turn out for this weekend's Sydney Mardi Gras parade, they'll be taking part in an event that's become tightly woven into the nation's cultural fabric. That wasn't always the case, and plans to place the event on the nation's heritage register is an important milestone for organisers of the 1978 protests that spawned the parade and at the time sparked a violent police response.
At about midnight, the celebration turned into what police say was an illegal procession, and more than 50 people were arrested on charges ranging from taking part in the procession to malicious injury.
Diane Minnis was one of those original 78ers, as they're known.
So this is a very big day for 78ers, very big day for activists, a very big day for Mardi Gras as a whole. Who would have thought that 48 years ago this would be happening?
I think that this listing delivers long overdue recognition of the genuine cultural importance of this event and the parade route to our whole country.
Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt today announced the Mardi Gras parade route will join 120 other sites around the country on the National Heritage List. It means that in future, anything that might be deemed to undermine the route's cultural value would need to be assessed and approved at the federal level.
You know, we often think about heritage matters being about physical buildings or physical structures, but it's so important that we respect and are proud of the cultural history of this country, because that is what makes us Australian almost more than anything else.
Apart from its symbolic status, the listing also means Mardi Gras organisers will now be able to seek Australian heritage grants from Commonwealth coffers. Taxpayer funding of the event has been contentious of late, with the New South Wales opposition calling for a review of state grants, accusing organisers of being hijacked by left-wing extremists. But organisers of the original Mardi Gras protests, like Ken Davis, argue it's more important than ever for the event's historical and cultural significance to be enshrined.
I think it's really, really important because Mardi Gras in different ways has shaped Sydney and, you know, Australian politics.
Tell me this, Ken Davis, as a young man convening that original march, did you ever in your wildest imaginings think that this could be something that would one day be on the National Heritage List?
No, not at all. I think it's always been like a watershed political event in Australia, particularly at a time when globally human rights and democratic rights are in retreat. And I think because Australia's contributed globally to a whole lot of democratic rights and human rights victories, it's really, really important that our government acknowledges this as a process, as a moment, as a key moment in the history of democracy or openness, you know, in Australia. lesbian, gay, transgender rights, but human rights in general and democracy in general are under sustained attack.
Original 78er Ken Davis ending that report by Nick Grimm. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. He spent almost 2 hours outlining what he believes to be a myriad of achievements. But has Donald Trump convinced voters that his first year in office has been a raging success? Today, Dr. Emma Shortis, a US politics expert at the Australia Institute, on President Trump's State of the Union address. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.